and some will follow that recommendation. They only do the one thing. Gurukaji is one example. Just stay with this and absolutely nothing else. And some will say, well, that helps me to concentrate, it helps me to keep focused on the particular. Others will say, I feel it's too limiting, it's too controlling, and after a period of time, I don't seem to be getting any more benefit. And then the person may need to re-examine themselves and to ask themselves, do I need to explore in some other way? And that's important to reserve that brief. Some people, in a way, are trying or tasting too many things. So the mind is under influence, so I'll do this for a little while, and I'll do that for a little while, then I'll do something else. It may be saying more about one's mind's relationship to the meditation than the meditation itself. And it does take some commitment, it takes dedication, some continuity to see what the real benefits of any meditation, and to see what the limitations of it are as well. So it does depend a little bit on how much real time one is putting into the meditation, and also, is one having some opportunity to have contact with a teacher or a person who's experienced in the process of meditation for some guidance, for some support, so that one has an opportunity to check the quality of one's meditation practice with somebody who knows the path much better and much further. So one is time and commitment in oneself to really see the value of a meditation, and the second is, I do think it's helpful to be able to check out somebody who knows the path of meditation more than, in this case, yourself. those will help.
So someone else can know what the man is, should experience.
It's not knowing
what someone should experience, because he cannot feel what I feel inside. He cannot experience what I experience for myself.
No, the value of someone who has more time, more years, and more experience is in asking and in exploring, being able to check and see and have a sense of how deep the person has gone in the meditation. Just as with other things of life, there are others who will know much more than we know about something, and that person can really help us along the way. And so that's one of the values, as the tradition, all deep traditions have said, the value of a mentor, the value of a teacher or teachers. Doesn't have to be a formal teacher, but someone who one recognizes and trusts has more depth of experience. And that can be very helpful for oneself. I don't think it's always helpful to rely upon one's own mind. Not always helpful. Yes, anyone, please. Yes.
I read your book, Light on Enlightenment.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Liked it very much. It gave me an impression that you are translating for us, for Westerns,
yes,
the Dharma.
Yep.
And that you do feel almost a Buddhist. So I was surprised to hear today that you don't identify yourself with Buddhism.
And I have the same, the person who was speaking, what's your name?
Mark.
Mark. I'm the same, he and I have some common personality, I think. So, you know, people, generally speaking, will say, refer to me Buddhist tradition. Of course, I have much love and respect for it, but I don't have much appetite for labels. I mean, I don't even like calling myself English. And at this time, I don't like it at all. etc. And, I was going to make a joke, but you're not. Let it go, I'm tempted. So I think, in other words, more importantly here, it's not important to be a Buddhist. It's very important to be a Buddha. That's the primary, to wake up, to be awake, which the Pali, the Sanskrit word is Buddha. And that's important. The label is a kind of social convention.
Okay, if so, I have another question.
Good.
So can you come to that, to awakening,
yes,
to be a Buddha, without practicing Buddhism or the Dharma?
Oh, yes, thank goodness. Oh, yes. One doesn't have to have heard of Buddhism, nor Dharma in the kind of Buddhist language, we might say. It's only to be regarded as a vehicle, as a means. And so the analogy of the Buddha himself is crossing the river, we use the boat, we row across the river. Reaching the other side, we might call it liberation, we might call it being awake, etc. Being awake means not imprisoned to birth and death. The crossing of the side and being awake with the boat, who wants to drag it on dry land? One lets it go. So when I was a young guy, I was hitchhiking on my way actually to Israel, and I was in a cave in Greece, I remember, it was in the hippie scene. Sex, drugs and rock and roll. Mostly drugs. And so in June of 67, you all know what happened. So the effect of which couldn't come to Israel, and hitchhiked across. So that was Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, etc., etc. So I went to see Ajahn Buddhadasa, means servant of the Buddha. He was a monk who lived in the forest more than 60 years. And so there's me, just a young guy in my early 20s. And I asked him a question about life. What's the meaning of life, or any significance to life, whatever it was, I can't remember. And he took hold of his robe, he pulled it off his shoulder, and like with the robe, and he said, "Nothing in life is worth being identified with. Nothing." And then he said, "Not even the idea of being a monk." I went, "Ooh, I can listen to this man." A few months later, shaved head, orange curtains for me. Curtains, boats. Curtains, well, my father called them. And so even the identity, even the label, English or Buddhist, hold it very lightly. When we were doing the dialogue workshops in Shrem, before this current nightmare, the meeting there, and which I was facilitating, Palestinians and Israelis, if there's going to be any meeting, the identity called, "I am an Israeli, you are a Palestinian," has to be held lightly. Long as one holds to this, you can't meet. Conflict. Get behind the label, the common humanity starts to be felt there. So we need to hold our labels, because our label is not who we are. "I am not a Buddhist." What does that mean? So then we can cut deeper. So that's the purpose. And it's fine to call oneself a Buddhist. I mean, on the international board of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. You know, quite comfortable with the label. But as I said to friends, if there was a monkey peace fellowship and I was invited to be on it, I'd be very happy to be a member of the monkey peace fellowship. No problem.
Labeling is like a border.
Is it like a
border?
A border. Yeah, exactly.
Making your borders when you have a label.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, we make. Yeah, so it's a kind of language for social reference. But there's no meaning, no significance to it. Similarly, with the earth, there are no countries on the earth. Mm. The earth doesn't know a country. It's all in here. And then it's imposed on. But there's no country on this earth. This is bizarre human behavior. And those silly little immigration officers around the world. Walk up to them, passport, look at it, look up, and look down. I mean, it's such a silly little ritual. And then one goes on. The earth is our home. Everywhere is home. Everywhere is for us. But somehow we've cut it all up into bits and pieces. Hopeless. Yes, anyone, please. So do you have any labels? Do you call yourself anything?
Myself?
Yes.
I'm a Jewish woman.
A Jewish woman?
Living now. It's also a label.
It is?
Right.
Pardon?
I live now at the 21st century.
Yes.
So it's a kind of a label.
Right.
And it doesn't depend on me either.
No.
It's just the time it goes on. And
yes.
This gives me a certain label.
Label, it's true. Do you feel, the important thing is not the label, labels are fine. I have the label teacher. It's fine, no problem. Do you The world is unstable.
The world has stopped labeling itself as a woman.
Yes, it is. Is it okay to leave it like that, or?
Take it out.
Oh, take it out. Do you feel with the label? Will this place still be here in 3 or 4 days? Do you feel that, if I may ask, you hold the label "I am a Jewish woman" lightly, or does it become a source of division?
First of all, we are not identifying ourselves as Jewish people. Others are identifying us, naming us, you can say.
Yeah.
All the rest of the world is. I mean, we did such thing in history that we took ourselves so seriously.
Yes.
The people of Israel and giving the Bible to the world probably contributed to that.
Yes.
That we brought that on ourselves, being so much different and so much, so we got that label.
Yes.
And now probably we are so much used to it that we are labeling all the others.
I see. All right. So sometimes in the world, as you say, the labels get back and forward. We forget to hold them in our consciousness rather lightly, and various others, for all sorts of motivations, as you point out, give great seriousness to the label and all the impact that can have. And then sometimes we also think, there's a label about us, give seriousness to it too, and the combination of that creates some pressure and division. Yeah. Common human problem often I don't think we realize how much our consciousness is caught in labels. Caught in them. As though the labels is reality. And it's just a label.
Also, this is a question of language.
Yes. Yes.
If it wouldn't be a language, which would be maybe was, we wouldn't have labels.
No, no, no. So it we, you know, as one of the great philosophers of the last century, Wittgenstein, reminds us and points out again and again how much we're imprisoned in our world of language. We're imprisoned into it. And if we see the limitations of it, that it's literally a word passing through the air, and a few letters on a piece of paper or whatever it might be, then maybe we can have a different sense, because we recognize the limitation of labels, limitations of language, there, and see it as conventional use, ways of talking, ways of writing, but not give it great seriousness, no great significance. Then liberation is very close.
It's also that the labels, it's like we meet people,
yes,
and start small talk,
yes,
and they ask you, what are you doing?
Yes, it's the favorite question in the West,
oh,
isn't it?
Oh my God, what am I going to tell them? That's how you label
it. It does.
Because it's like you can't have the whole day telling them they don't. They'll be interested, but you don't always have the time to really tell what you are doing.
No, I know. I know.
So you say, I'm a drama teacher, and that's a label. Oh, and they say, oh.
Yeah,
yeah,
sure.
Right. Or, I'm a mother, and that's labeling.
Exactly.
Right?
It's not easy to have a conversation without it. I agree. Some people say to me, what are you doing? And I say, well, right now I'm standing here talking to you. And they say, oh.
Right.
That's not enough.
Yeah, yeah, but then they think you are, yeah, you know.
Yeah, they do.
True. No, because it's not the rules of talking.
Yes, yes,
right.
Yes, exactly.
But perhaps one should break these rules.
Sometimes, just to step outside of the familiar. With some amusement, you know, not too seriously.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely.
Happened to me today.
Oh, did it? Go on.
Yeah. I have left a place that I was working for a few years, and I came back today to review a contract.
Mm.
And I was reviewing the contract for 3 hours.
What kind of work? Can I ask?
Good man.
No, right. Mm.
And I was reviewing the contract, and people kept coming into my room. And they say, hey, what are you doing? Mm. And I say, I'm reviewing a contract. They say, no. What are you doing now? Mm. You don't have a job here. So I said, nothing. Now I'm reviewing the contract. I said, how come?
Yes, yes.
You probably went to that place and you want to tell us about it.
Yes, yes. It's a little bit, I think, we spend so much time either with ourselves or with each other talking about doing. You know, we're not human beings anymore, we're human doings. and so we get used to talking about what we have done and what we are doing and what we will be doing or should be doing, and it's doing. And there's no time to stop. No time just to be still. No time for the human being to come back in a little bit more. So some periods of calmness, relaxation, and the sense of being, human being, to let that be established more. Because otherwise the human doing, and human busying. We have no time for life because we're so much in the thought of what we have to do.
But then you are labeled as a bum.
Pardon?
Then you are labeled as a bum.
As a bum. Yeah, it's true. It's true. So
Dharma bum.
Yes, there's a good tradition of Dharma bums. Why not? Yes, please.
Maybe being is doing what you like to do.
Yes.
Isn't this something important in life?
Yes.
Doing, being interested in what you like, in what you're
yes.
interested
yes.
in. And this is doing. And so doing and being is together, it goes together.
Beautiful, I mean a very lovely and good point, I quite agree. So, when we enjoy what we do, there's a sense of being there and being present, being interested, being connected with, being focused upon. So the sense of being is coming. Others may say, oh, you're doing a lot. You seem to be very busy, etc., etc. But the sense inside of ourselves, because of love for what we do, that we really feel we're just being present, doing what we love to do, in the sense of being there. I can say, you know, sitting here right now, it's a great privilege to serve the Dharma, just being present. You know, somebody else will say, oh, earlier on today you were doing the Dharma Facilitators program up in Clearly, and now this is what you're doing. But the senses of love and connection and appreciation for that. I think sometimes busyness and doing is problematic because of resistance.
Because of what?
Resistance. Hmm? We're doing it, but we don't want to be doing it. We don't want to be busy. We don't want to have the feeling and the thought, I have so much to do. And so the resistance comes in. And the stress comes because there's the desire to get things done. That's one force inside. And the other force is the fear of not getting it done, or not getting it done properly, or not getting it done on time. Desire to get it done, the fear and the resistance of not getting it done, put those two forces inside, recipe for stress, recipe for it. But when there is love and enjoyment and the sense of being, the whole relationship is completely different, because as you point out, being and doing blend, like the Buddha said, together like milk and water.
Mm-hmm. Milk and water.
Yes.
About the awakening process.
Awakening process, yeah.
I'm a little bit worried.
Worried? Oh, yeah. How unusual here. Sorry, go on. Yeah.
How can one know if he is awakening or just replacing one belief system with another, replacing one group of habits with
yes.
a different one?
Yeah, it's a good and an important concern here. It isn't easy, but it would take some degree of trust in the process. We may not know for sure, but there's some general sense that as a human being, we are developing as a human being. That development may include letting go of overcoming some of the old painful habits and developing better ones. You know, maybe overcoming a habit of eating unhealthy food and developing a better habit of eating healthier food. It is still a habit. It's still, to some degree, a belief, this is better than this. So belief and habit can still be working for us, even as developing as a human being. The important point is to be aware and clear about it. Even if we're changing from an unhealthy habit to a healthy habit, to be as clear and aware about it as possible. Because the clarity and the awareness about it, that awareness is the element that's waking us up to be very clear about the process. Similarly with beliefs, you know, with, let's say, religious beliefs or philosophical beliefs, are they contributing to helping us, but not making any belief the end in itself? Otherwise it becomes, as we heard earlier from Mark, if we make the belief the most important thing, that belief will become a dogma. And we forget that it can just be a support to waking us up. One may believe initially that meditation is good, but one may then have to practice to see what its benefits are. One may believe some sharing and discussing this evening is good, but one may have to explore that, as we are doing, to see what the benefits are. So we want to be clear about what are unhealthy habits, we want to be clear about what healthy habits are, we want to be mostly clear and trust in our experience that it feels valid, it feels worthwhile. And our awareness will help to give us the clarity so that we're not falling into dogma. Or we're not limiting and imprisoning ourselves to beliefs. Beliefs is not the final thing, just a support sometimes. So do you have any particular beliefs or habits or things in mind when you were speaking?
Yes, I suppose yes, but I feel that if we ask probably everyone,
yes,
in the street, nobody will say that he is living while sleeping.
No.
Everyone has a sense that he is living awake. It's an illusion. So it can be an illusion, because we know that not all of us are awake. As you say, it's in the sense of awareness, in the sense of being now.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So, just as you pointed out, the deep sense of awareness in life, to really live a really conscious life, I feel is a very, very precious thing for us as human beings. And if we're not, then the sleepwalk, the living life just out of habits and patterns with a kind of unquestioning obedience to them all, and not really stopping and not really asking ourselves, does it really matter? Is it really important? This, that and the other which I make such a fuss about, is it really that significant? And that kind of ability to question, to stop, to let go of, shows that we are awake to our existence, and that we want to bring out. And it's a little bit like, if you ever go in these old Gothic churches in Europe, you go to the nave, to the altar, and these old architects, they've got a beam of light running down onto top of the nave, on top of the altar, and through a skylight or a window at the very top of these old cathedrals, light shines down, and one appreciates the light, but simultaneously one sees all the dust. And awareness is a little bit like that. If we really bring greater awareness to our life, we bring more light to life, but we'll see more dust in ourselves. That's the price, but it's worth it. Yes, please.
I want to take it back to our conversation.
Yes, please.
Being stressed. If do you think that stress is a part of personality? If Is there any possible driving it away somehow?
Pardon?
I mean, you pointed out how bad it is to be stressed.
Yes.
About this and about that. And it's very common here around.
Yes.
In our country. So, is it something that's built in a personality, or is there a way of driving it away or changing oneself to being less stressed?
Yes.
The common things that make us stressed every day.
Stress is only a personality phenomenon, not born with. It comes mostly through inner and outer conditions, produces the stress. And as I say, stress is this mixture, difficult mixture of desire and fear, mostly. And we get so used to it that sometimes the stress, of course, then begins to have an impact on the body, on the cells. Tiredness, exhaustion, discomfort, pains, contractions in the stomach area, all signs of stress. So quite often, when it starts to deepen itself, it can just start off at the mental level, feeling overworked, too much information, too much knowledge, too cerebral, etc. You know, work, study is common. It begins to get a grip, and then it kind of starts moving into the emotional life. The anxiety would be a common expression of the emotional life, worry. And if it's ignored, then it starts to get into the cells, actually get into the body. Tiredness is a common, feeling too tired, feeling lethargic, and lots of resistance to lots and lots of things, and then trying to compensate. It could be, you know, food, alcohol, drugs, etc., etc., to kind of get away from the stress.
Yeah.
So it's very important, I feel, that we really look at ourselves, and once again we stop and ask ourselves, where in my life do I feel stress? Or where in my life do I feel the most stress? What will need to change so that I don't live with stress? And therefore taking the power out of it. Sometimes the processes of different meditation practices can be a great help. Sometimes it's looking at lifestyle. Sometimes it's asking ourselves, what do I need to let go of? What do I need to learn to do without so that there is less stress in my life? Because if the stress starts going out, the happiness will start coming in. And that's what we love most, to feel happy. So it's just 10 o'clock. Good flow together. Let's have a quiet minute together just to end the evening. And thank you for Zora for the translating. Just sitting, being a mindful, conscious human being here and now. So that we are just settling into and resting in the present moment. just 10 o'clock. Thank you for taking the time to come this evening. We have a full program throughout the day. Have we put the timetable up or anything yet? Yeah. Do you know what time we kick off tomorrow?
5:45.
And then?
Six o'clock is yoga.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
6:20.
6:20.
All right. Very good. So with the day tomorrow, we those of you who are here, we start the day off with the wake up bell, and then there's yoga and meditation and the breakfast. During the morning period, there are small group meetings with the teachers, and the program that gets on underway. So again, very, very welcome to come any time, any hour of the day. And we'll put up on the notice board at breakfast time more details about the day in terms of the small groups and the themes and the hours of the sitting, etc., etc. So those who are staying, enjoy a hot drink and good rest, good sleep. Those who are returning home this evening, good journey home, and hope to see you all again. Thank you.
Talking about a wall of incomprehension, I know it's a cliche, but it seems like I could see that I can be in situations like that where she. But I wanted to say something else entirely, actually. But that was the session where she'd reached a point where, despite the best intentions of people on both sides, she felt that she couldn't bring all of herself to her Palestinian friends.
Yes.
And that something like that has arisen. I hope I'm not making a mountain out of a molehill between me and you that I wanted to tell you about.
Yes.
You know, I told you that when I read your book that I found a place for myself, for a forgotten part of myself, a Jewish child in school
in Plymouth,
experiencing anti-Semitism, and that I felt safe with you as the author to be a Jew relating to somebody who I knew wasn't Jewish.
Yes.
And I cried tears of gratitude and I don't know what else.
Yes.
And you know that I like your book. And actually I don't think it's true that that trust is broken, but it's certainly in the same area of meaning that something difficult has arisen.
Yes.
About the Holocaust. Because you were talking about this Second World War.
Sorry to interrupt you a little bit. There. What I would like this evening, as I mentioned, is a topic or a theme. After I have one or two specific topics or theme, I'll speak about that. After that, there can be some exploration rather than before. And that's the guideline and the outline I just mentioned. So if possible, you could just put it, it's not easy, but in just into one sentence what you would like the theme to be, or to put it in one or two words.
You can't talk about Jewish specificity, the specificity of my experience as a Jew, that I felt that you said something that did not that I couldn't find myself in what you said.
So what you would like to talk about is the inability of others to talk about specificity of somebody else. Is that the request?
No, it's more that we shouldn't be negating the past so much that it doesn't matter what you say about the past, because the thing is to be here and now. If we're going to talk about the past, then we need to find out ways that others can recognize a shared past.
All right. So, okay, all right. So one area is looking at ways that we can explore, look at our shared past and that relationship to the present together. One theme. Are there any other that would be useful to explore?
Could you speak and your experience, not theory, but your experience of freedom?
My experience of freedom?
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting this evening. Yes, go on.
Can you find also the connection between fear and freedom?
Fear and freedom, yeah. Yes. Good ones. All right. Anyone else? Are there any other? Or is that more than enough for a lifetime? Enough.
Good.
So let's have a couple of quiet minutes together, please, and then see how. Exploring a little bit of the themes that were suggested just now, I would like to explore from the everyday relative way of looking at things, and then from another way of looking, which is outside of the relative. And I would say in this respect that both matter, the exploration of both matters, and it would be a great pity with life if we concentrated in one, i.e. the conventional, the relative, the ordinary and the everyday, and failed to take the opportunity to really examine and explore what's outside of the view of ourself. So here we are, you and I. We find ourselves born into this world, and it would seem that in coming into this world we have a number of tendencies, number of patterns. Some of us have perhaps got brothers and sisters, and we think, my goodness me, here I am in a situation where my brothers and sisters and I are brought up in the same household, had contact with the same parents over a number of years, possibly went to the same schools, lived in such a similar environment. And when I look at my brother and my sister, younger or older than myself, I see what extraordinary differences. How different we are as two people, or two young people. The interests, the priorities, the focus, what matters, what doesn't matter. We find it hard to explain a little bit, but why is that so when we're brought up with same parents, same situation, same genes, same environment, etc., etc.? So here we are living in a world where we have these tendencies which seem to be somewhat different from each other, even in the same family, and also with regard to each other. And our sense of our identity as a human being is largely affected and influenced, of course, by our background. That may reflect and show itself in life. Where we are born, with whom we are born, and all the kind of influences that we come into this world with and which we relate to others. So the sense of and the feeling and the identity of me and who I am arises out of this flow of conditions. Sometimes we found it necessary in this flow of conditions to actually put our attention back to what was. And it's a wonderful capacity of men and women to be conscious enough to actually turn our attention to our past, whatever the past may be, personal, social, collective, or whatever. And we ask ourselves, if we turn our attention to the past, and I'm referring to any kind of experience at any particular time, what way is the turning of our attention to the past valuable? What way is it healthy and helpful? In some respect, we cannot get to the past. In some respect, we could be bold and say, I cannot get to the past, I cannot reach it, feel it, handle it, communicate with it, I cannot go back to what was. Are we together, or is our attention somewhere else? I cannot go back to what was. What I have is the capacity of the attention to turn. And what I have is impressions. What I have is memory. I cannot get to it and look at it. All that I can do is, in the present moment, allow, which can be healthy or unhealthy. Thoughts, perceptions and feelings arise about what I perceive to be what was, with regard to anything. Babies have their nature too. Babies cry, dogs bark, teachers talk. What's the difference? So my attention turns to the past, and you and I probably every day, about something or other, the attention turns to the past. But as I asked a moment ago, what is a healthy way of looking towards the past, towards what was, about anything, anything? Sometimes I look at the past and I want the past to be healthy and helpful for me to live wisely and clearly in the present. And therefore my intention and my attitude is very precisely that. But sometimes I want the past, and I go, as it were, I can't go to it, but I go to it, as it were. And what I find, I just keep going over it and over it and over it. It becomes a difficulty with our past. Something has happened, and somehow in my experience of yesterday, or last week, or last month, or last year, or whatever it might be for us, seems to keep being reinforced. Sometimes we talk with our friends about it. We were listening to this afternoon, and sometimes our friends find it helpful for us. But sometimes what happens with us when we're talking about what happened yesterday or last week or last month is that we get so caught up in it. We don't really want to move on from it. We want to be in it. We want to be caught up in it. We want to keep going over it again and again and again. And somehow this, with what was, somehow acts, like the therapist will say for us, sometimes it will act like a shadow over what is. We can't see the present moment clearly enough because the defining moment of the present is from yesterday. And what we find for that is that we're unable to see what is clearly because its measurement, its conclusion about what is from yesterday. We have an argument with somebody, we have a difficulty with him or her. It leaves an impression. It was what happened yesterday. It didn't happen today, it happened yesterday. And the shadow of the image of the memory with something unsatisfactory casts its shadow straight over the present moment, we can't see this person, because what we see is the image. He, she said this to me. We discussed some of this afternoon together. So this relationship to the present matters, and its relationship to it is, can I look at the past and I can say with hand on heart, there is nothing worth holding on to in the past about anything? Could I be so bold as a human being in relationship to anything of yesterday, for the purpose to be able to discover as a free human being what is in the present without the shadow, what is in the present without the memory, what is in the present without the old identity? Many people say it's not possible. Many people say, I'm not willing to do this. Many people say, I need my past. Many people will say, well, this is who I am. Many people will say, well, this is who we are. And so we find ourselves in such a form of relationship with existence where what was, which is old and dead, and I'm including tradition here, including thoughts, I'm including memories, all the way down the line, that what is gone and finished because we cannot get to it, we can only talk about it, think about it, write about it, we can't get to it, what's actually gone and over with human beings, and human beings alone, or sentient beings alone, end up carrying with it, with us. And Dharma teachings, which are intended to make the self feel very uncomfortable, it's not a comfortable teaching, it's not a pleasant teaching to satisfy the self. It's a teaching to challenge it. It's a teaching to question identity all the way down the line. And as I say, few people are willing to go all the way with it, because it threatens the self, and it is intended to. But if we're willing to say, let me for once explore this, let me for once see if this is possible, the Buddha, and in all spiritual teachings, not just people like Christopher, have spoken of this much more determinedly and rather fiercely and directly than I am. I'm not too polite an Englishman, though some doubt it. In the Swamis, the sadhus, the renunciates, I don't mean these pseudo-renunciates coming out of the Osho wallahs, I mean genuine renunciates, genuine sannyasins, the tradition asked of them that the Swami would say to the sadhu, you take a dip in the Mother Ganga, in the river Ganges, and in that full immersion there is a vow, there is a commitment, and this commitment is, I give up my entire past, without any questions, I give up my entire past, I give up all claims to inheritance, I give up all ownership of land, and I have one vow in life, to give up fear. Bhaya, the word, I give up fear, living in fear. And in the tradition of ancient India, this became and was regarded, a lot of it's lost now unfortunately, is regarded as a major turning point in the consciousness, not because the past is the problem, because it's past, it's dead, it's over with, but because of what it stops realizing in the present, about the present. The Buddha, in rather the same spirit of things, he said to the men and women who went into homelessness, the Sanskrit word is bhikshu or bhikkhuni, he said, give it all up. The whole spirit of renunciation, give it all up. And then, what was left? And he said two responses to this. He said, regard oneself, and the word he used is akinchana, not a message, which is very popular in secular culture. Akinchama means nobody. Regard yourselves as akinchana, regard yourself as a nobody. And the word bhikkhu or bhikshu or bhikkhuni for the women, the literal meaning of it is beggar. In other words, if we're going to discover and look and clearly into life, it's almost the opposite message of everything we have ever been told. What we've been told is identify. What we've been told is be somebody. What we have been told is become somebody. What we have been told is doing, 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 doing. And we've swallowed this message lock, stock and barrel. We worship this message. We are in obedience to this message of being somebody through identity, past, being somebody in the present moment, and becoming somebody. And spiritual teachings in the deepest sense says no, no, no. If one is keen to know what liberation, one goes, does, as it were, polar opposite to everything we have been told. And it's no wonder people will say, I can't, you couldn't do that here in this world. You can't live like that. You can't discover that. You can't realize that. I'm not about to go off to India and live in a cave and live off vegetables. Can't do that. Actually, one could. Some of us have. So I'm not saying that we can't. Oh, yes, one could. Tiny minority will do it, but one can. Every time one says, I can't, I think we should say, why not? Why not? However, it's very unlikely you'll be booking your next flight out to India tomorrow morning after this talk, so we'll have to take with what is. So, in the same kind of spirit, if, as profound spiritual teachings point out and deep mystical experiences point out, it's an extraordinary thing in life to have the guts, it takes guts, to actually question not only what makes me feel comfortable, what makes me feel uncomfortable, but also what makes me feel comfortable about anything. What? And therefore this challenge to us is an extraordinary challenge, because the poor old ego, there's some of you will be sitting here already rebelling about the idea of being nobody, already rebelling about the idea about becoming somebody better. My favorite rabbi was born in Bethlehem, brought up in Nazareth. You know who I'm talking about. He said 2,000 years ago, it's the same message, be ever watchful, the kingdom of God is at hand. He says in the first of the Beatitudes, he doesn't say, blessed are the rich in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. It's a huge thing to actually challenge the might of the idea of I and its past, and to be able to say it appears it has a relative usefulness, that's all, but deep significance it doesn't have. It doesn't have. It's in the realms of ideas and beliefs and the self. Sometimes in our relationship to past, to present, some people will say, I'm having a problem with my past. I'm having difficulty with it. In the West, the psychotherapist has replaced the priest. There are more astrologers in France than there are parish priests. The priest says, has faith, have faith, and the public says, I haven't got any, so you're no good to me. So we go to the counsellors, we go to the professionals, we go to those who very helpfully can help us make and come to some understanding of what was. And there's constant attempts to do this. The scientists and those are very often engaged in what was. The whole Darwinian theory, there's a magazine stuck out there on the table on science and Buddhism and the evolutionary theories and its relationship to Buddhism. Interesting stuff, but no relevance to it. And there's this the past that we look at. And sometimes we will say, my past is problematic, I need to talk about it. Fair enough, why not? Be a great help. But sometimes we haven't actually made up our mind whether we really want to resolve it. Talking about it doesn't mean anything. And you can pay, I don't know how much you pay these days to go see the therapist, but California, my friends tell me it's anything these days between the cheap end of the scale is around $70 and the upper end could be $140 for about whatever 50, 45 or 50 minutes. My gosh, for $80.